You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. You are with Marie here, and yes, new place, new time, new day. But as promised yesterday, Marty hasn't gone anywhere, and here we are for Media Matters. It sort of kind of feels a bit weird. I feel a little bit
dislocated,
discombobulated, but we're here.
Because we're sort of doing it a day later, I had a perfect storm because in tidying up, some member of my household took two papers that I was desperately searching for last week and put them in a cupboard that doesn't normally have that sort of thing in it. So I found them, and so it sort of extended my week in both directions.
Yes, there you go. And of course, I was away. I mentioned that last week. I went down to Wellington. I've had 2 days literally sitting right in the heart of Parliament with the student Chogham. I did feel like an interloper, considering last time I was there, I was protesting, but there you go.
Yeah. Leaky building syndrome in the wasp's nest, eh? A bit of the river of filth sort of slipping in.
I know. Well, it was, I mean, look, it's a truly beautiful building. I have to say that first and foremost. And my son is walking on air. He had a wonderful time at the Student Chogham, and the young people that run that event, which are all students themselves, did an incredible job. And I got to meet Nancy Yu from National. She's listed for National, and she was utterly delightful. And she was sort of kind of like the patron political figure for the event. So she was there. She dipped in and out and, yeah, had some time.
Bumped into a few secret RCR listeners as well.
Did bump into a few.
They're out there.
I won't put your pot on, but you spoke to one of the staffers and was like, oh, actually, I listened to you guys. I'm like, ooh.
Don't be afraid to share.
Exactly.
Yep.
it was an interesting experience. And the one thing, before we dive in, I'll just share this now. They had the memorial session for the passing of King Tuheitia, and it ran from 2 to 4. We went in 3 to 4. And it was actually quite nice, I think, for all the kids to see a house that was actually united and not divided and bickering with each other.
Might have given them entirely the wrong idea.
could have, but it was incredibly moving, and just everybody's tributes and remembrances of King Tuheitia. And in the right at the very end, well, there were three things that stood out for me. One, Tuiana Tuiono, who insisted on having his entire 5 minutes in Te Reo, which was quite garbled at points that even the translator couldn't translate what he was saying. Just the arrogance. It's like, you've got an entire full chamber. There was only a couple of people missing. So the entire chamber was full. It was more about him and not about
him. Yeah. Wanted to be judged not by the content of his character, but the color of his skin.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, it's like, really, mate. You know, this is not the time to be virtue signaling. So I thought he was quite distasteful. That was quite distasteful. And most people were ignoring him because of it. So it's like, really? But then in contrast, Lamaipi Clark got up, and Kingitanga is very personal. She knew Tuheitia. She knows the family. She knows the new queenie. She's, you know, she's been raised in that movement. And I mean, let's face it, she ousted Nanaia in the election, and her speech was stunning. It was 5 minutes of the most impressive oratory I've ever seen.
I'll have to dig it out and listen to it. Any opportunity I have to rethink people who I have a certain opinion of, I do welcome. It's just a healthy sign, I guess.
Then next minute, we go back to the chamber to go and do what, you know, back kids were doing, finishing up the Congress. And there she was. She came in. She wasn't scheduled to do it, but she saw all, I think, everybody up in the gallery, and she made a point of coming down, meeting some of the kids, you know, and seeing what was literally what was going on. And I thought, good on her, you know. I was like, okay, all right.
I must say, I heard Debbie Ngaro Opaka say the only graceful thing I've ever heard her say. Like, normally everything I hear her say is just so imbued with hatred and bitterness and resentment and anger and bloodlust. And she actually said something graceful. So, you know, anything we can do to say, yeah, let's keep doing that. Not because, you know, we're afraid of you, but just because I don't like being just sick of you. Mm. And increasingly, you know, I talk about this sometimes with Māori, you know, like every time you see Māori, they're just moaning and blaming other people for their problems and just when you listen to them, you think, man, you know, if that attitude gains traction and it finds an opposition, it's really not taking the country in a good place, good direction. So
no, and just embodying that spirit of kotahitanga and realizing that kotahitanga is actually unity. It's pulling together on what you share, your shared commonalities, your shared interests, your shared goals. It doesn't actually mean that we say this and we want you to, and if you don't follow what we want, then therefore you're being divisive. It's actually compromise and consensus, you know, discussion.
I was scrolling, and I came across an article about Eden Achbez, who was a strange hermit who lived under in California in a cave under one of the L's in the Hollywood sign. He'd written a few songs that had charted, and one night in 1947, he went backstage in the Lincoln Theatre in Los Angeles and gave a song to Nat King Cole, which was Nature Boy. Actually, if I make a song request for this program, Nat King Cole, Nature Boy, let's hear it. Anyway, it made the charts, but there was one comment he made that really struck me, his comment when he was asked about racism. And he said, some white people hate black people and some white people love black people. Some black people hate white people and some black people love white people. So you see, it's not an issue of black and white. It's an issue of lovers and haters. And so if we're talking about kotahitanga, I think it's the lovers who've got to get together. And the haters are going to keep getting progressively crazier and crazier. And the longer we abdicate our duty to love, the longer we let them run with their crazy stuff so it becomes some sort of twisted orthodoxy, kind of a satanistic, narcissistic staring of human intellect at its own reflection and falling in love with it, the worse things are going to get.
Mm-hmm. We're going to start this morning. There's a lot going on this morning. And one of the places that we thought we would both start is what's been going on with the universities. This has been bubbling along for a while. There was a leaking in Saturday's paper, Saturday's Herald. Benjamin Plummer, AUT professor, fumes at staff for leaking workplace survey results. An internal survey at the Auckland University of Technology, AUT Law School, has revealed issues with its work culture, with one staffer saying they believe there would be serious consequences for speaking up against senior leadership. And one senior professor has clapped back at staff for leaking results of the survey after no action was allegedly taken to address the unsatisfactory results, saying they should leave if they are unhappy. So this survey of 26 law staff responded to the Voice survey. So it's a small sample, but it's obviously not a huge faculty. 20% have personally experienced discrimination at work in the last 6 months. 35%, so that's a third, have personally experienced bullying or harassment at work in the past 6 months. 30% feel comfortable reporting inappropriate behaviour, and 5% believe AUT would intervene if someone was not delivering a role. After the leaking of the results of the survey, AUT Professor of Law Paul Myberg sent an email to all law staff with the subject line, "The coward who did this should be utterly ashamed of themselves." I refer back to the 35% who have been personally experienced bullying or harassment in the last 6 months. I continue. Civilized human beings wash their dirty linen indoors. And if you're that unhappy, please do us all a favour and leave. We'll hold the door open for you so it doesn't hit your ass on the way out, the email read. Well, quite the stash.
Yeah, he's a pugilistic fellow, isn't he? He's South African by the look of it. He's got his pronouns, as all AUT staff do, in his profile. It was a heavy week of media, and there was a lot of flat-out craziness, and literal Marxism slipped into the papers as comment, often with little or no counter from saner voices. And we can trace a lot of this plume of effluent to a sewage pipe in Auckland called Auckland University. You know, the Dean of Law School recently, you know, has been in the news again, Kylie Quince, who attracted that publicity when she called a senior KC a racist dinosaur and said he should go off and die in a corner. Now, AUT's response to that was a statement. I appreciate that the last few days may have been difficult for law school colleagues and students following media coverage about Kylie's posts on her personal Facebook page. AUT has been working with her to ensure she is safe and supported. I can now confirm I have spoken with Kylie and that there is no ongoing disciplinary process in relation to this matter. The old cry bullies. And we've seen a lot of cry bullying. You know, AUT, I get a bit mixed up with them, AUT, Auckland University. It's tough to make a distinction between them. Is there a, like...
Well, oh, look, I mean, they're two very separate entities, but are they two sides of the same coin from an ideological perspective?
That survey you pointed to earlier does highlight a serious, serious problem. And the problem I have with it is, you know, I mentioned the lovers earlier versus the haters. We've got a process at work here where money is getting taken off the lovers and given to the haters who are promulgating all of these various theories in this incredibly convoluted language to take more money off people. And there's this contempt for the lumpen proletariat that's throughout what they're doing, sighing, oh, well, what do the people of New Zealand know? There was a Law Society complaint.
Oh, just while you're finding your papers, I'm just going to read another little tranche out of this article from Benjamin Plummer. Myberg continues with, when approached by the Herald, Myberg said he would always stand by his comments. I know exactly who leaked this private information in a breach of the Privacy Act and their employment contract, and I have utterly no time or sympathy for people who fell their own nest in bad faith simply because they are disaffected, unprofessional, and their own petty ambitions have not come to fruition. He said this is not a case of bullying, but instead a case of bad faith actors and a personal vendetta. Shame on you, Myberg says. A spokesperson from AUT said that they were concerned about the results of the survey. Our focus is now on working with the school to understand what can be done to improve their experience at work. One staffer wrote an internal email, I appreciate that there are likely flaws to the survey. However, the answers to those questions that are specifically relevant to the law school do consistently reveal that some colleagues are genuinely unhappy at work. And I think that that's, you know, I mean, everything else aside, if the culture of an organisation or a faculty like a university is unhappy, that is not going to perform. You've got to have a happy team in order to be effective and productive. So from that standpoint alone, this should be taken seriously and investigated. And it doesn't help that you have a rather sparky head who sort of then starts to demonstrate some of the concerns that those that he works with are expressing. So it will be it will be intriguing to see. And I mean, the university sector as a whole are in crisis. So what did you, have you found?
The Law Society speaks out over move on gang patches and homes. And there was a quote from the convener of the Law Society's Criminal Law Committee, Chris Macklin, who said it was alarming that a power with such broad consequences was introduced after the select committee process, meaning organisations, experts and the public could not have their say. This amendment came so far after the consultation process and so close to what would have been would be the bill's third reading that it's almost like it's been railroaded, Macklin said, without a trace of irony that this is pretty much how we've got the treaty principles. You know, poor lawyers. Now they know how Kiwis feel. And this mistaking the treaty principles, which have gradually been introduced by an activist legal fraternity, conflating changing them with changing the treaty. Now, there's that, everyone puts that toi tu te treaty, te tiriti on it. It's like leaves the, it literally means leave the treaty undisturbed. It's like, yeah, that's what David Seymour's bill aims to do because it has been disturbed and had all sorts of things read into it by lawyers.
Mm.
But, you know, just before we leave AUT, I mean, yeah, you can go right through the papers. And you know, the other one that was incredible, it was an editorial in the weekend and the Sunday Herald and the Weekend Herald. And it had a comment in it from University of Auckland criminologist Dr. Ronald Kramer, who also spoke of the reality of homicide cases, reiterating that victims and perpetrators typically know each other and incidents are rare. And he says, most murders, people getting angry and kind of losing their shit. There's something unpredictable about events like that. It's probably not a pattern that's going to repeat, Kramer said. When stuff like this happens, we draw attention to it and we worry about it. But the reality is, I wouldn't be afraid of this. It's just so statistically unlikely that anyone would be randomly murdered. The thing that is maybe more disturbing to people is that there's no way to control this kind of phenomenon. Now, pretty casual speech from an academic for a start, saying that murder is basically people losing their shit, right? And sort of just waving away, it's nothing to be afraid of, it's nothing to worry about. When you actually go and look at who this guy is, he's a Marxist, and he believes that prison should be abolished. So if you look at his LinkedIn, it says, and contrast this with his informal speech in the paper, my current work focuses on collective consumption of crime data and ableism and speciesism. This work draws from critical disability studies and CRIP theory. Concerning analytical direction, it is indebted to radical constructivism, postmodern or post-structural criminology, sort of that means post-Marxism, postmodernism, and narrative criminology. Previous work explores technology fetishism in relation to crime control / science, cultural criminology, and graffiti writing and street art. My work generally examines the construction and articulation of cultural frameworks that infuse processes of criminalization and normalization. I mean, you can read some of his work, and it's just so drawing from Marxist theories of penality. We show that correctional officers seek to reconfigure the subjectivity of young incarcerated men in ways that adjust them to economic inequalities. For instance, they frequently portray labor markets as accessible and readily offering stable employment opportunities. When correctional officers acknowledge structural limitations and racial inequality, they are likely to dismiss such concerns by insisting upon the power of individual choice to overcome social barriers. We consider why correctional officers embrace neoliberal ideologies and note some implications for future research. He says, I would put youth crime from a 2023 pre-election article in Newsroom. I would put youth crime down to the subtext, and a fairly transparent one at that, for the desire to control Maori and Pacifica young people. Discussions about youth crime then are ultimately about colonizers and the colonized and serving and protecting the colonizers by political regimes via their law and order, in inverted commas, proposals. Most political parties are essentially promising not to upset the status quo, not to interfere with the ongoing project of colonization, especially its racist and classist dimensions. This guy is on the front page of the Herald telling us not to worry about crime.
Well, I said to you when we were prepping for this a couple of days ago, while sitting in the belly of the beast, I said to you, you know, a theme that has hit me like an absolute sledgehammer has been ideological application confronting with real world outcomes, which again, I guess, is you reap what you sow.
Mm.
Just staying with the universities before we move, take this theme elsewhere. I also communicate with a retired emeritus professor, John Rung, and John had a fantastic piece recently in Bassett, Brash and Hyde. So do make sure you hunt that one out. And it's talking about universities in crisis. And he does a deep dive. And universities are in crisis. You and I have been talking about this on Media Matters now for 18 months. Their enrollment numbers are tumbling. And it's not just universities. Te Pūkenga is also facing the same fate. You've got cost cutting going on left, right and centre. My husband was studying at Massey. He's now actually moved his online course to the University of London because Massey has turned into such a pile of steam cultural dung that even a computer science degree, which is what he was pursuing, just he couldn't get that completed effectively because of what was going on in the priorities. And just some data from that article from John, tumbling international student numbers. In 2019, 117,000 students were enrolled with a income, because they pay higher over and above the odds of Kiwi students, of about $5 billion. In 2020, there was a shortfall to that budget of $20 million, and in 2021, the shortfall to the budget is now $600 million, and it equates to about a 15% loss in total revenue. And the international students simply are not coming back. part of the reason they're not coming back is exactly like what you've just pointed out now with these knifings and murders that have gone on in Auckland. But don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Come on back. Everything will be fine.
Spate of violence, no cause for fear. Cheryl on Sunday editorial headline.
Exactly. But these parents see this, and why would they send them back? The Hermit Kingdom shut itself off. Everywhere else is opened up. So these parents are sending their children to Canada and Australia and the United Kingdom. They're not sending them here like they used to. It's just not happening. And also, too, you throw that in the perfect storm in the world of universities. You throw that, too, between the staffing ratios. So the staffing ratios in New Zealand of non-academic versus academic, in New Zealand it's 1.5 to 1 non-academic staff than there are academic staff. So 1.5 to 1. Whereas in the United States or the United Kingdom or the US is 0.8 to 1. We're already heavily overburdened by all of these non-academic staff. And you think to yourself, well, what benefit do they bring? Well, they're there for health and safety, learning support, pastoral care, outreach, Māori and Pacifica and DEI. That's what they're there for. But is that making a tangible difference to our students? Well, something's going on because the kids are just not going back.
What do they bring? I mean, you get your AUT Professor of Law, Paul Meibergs, they actually end up bringing a negative sometimes. Obviously, you know, the way he's vociferously defending, attacking people who are saying, hey, we've got some problems here. Mm. I mean, he's the guy who's blocking it being addressed.
Yeah.
And if you've got just 5% of people who say, if someone is not delivering in their role, we will do something about it. 5% of people think, have confidence that if someone's not doing their job, something's going to be done about it. That, I mean, that's amazing.
That's shocking. So if you want to hear more about this, Paul did a wonderful interview with Dr. Elizabeth Brata on Monday. I thoroughly, thoroughly encourage you to go back and listen to that. And she has been ringing this bell with a number of academics now for years. She, of course, was one of the listener seven. She has been highlighting how the likes of Ways of Knowing, Mātauranga Māori, have been brought into things like the science curriculum. And she distills things so beautifully. As she said, she has no issues with all of those things, but everything in the right time and place.
Mm.
And she also looks at the takeover, the cultural and ideological takeover of these institutions, and she breaks it down into three quite distinct groups. One is going to your point that you just highlighted there with Kramer, you know, in terms of a Marxist critical theory connection, heavily overrepresented. Elizabeth also talked about the tribalism, the groups of tribalists who are very, very strong within the university sphere, and actually outlines what that means. And we're seeing that now in regards to this treaty and principles debate. And then the third group are the postmodernists. Her description for postmodernism was probably the best I've ever heard. And she just said, postmodernism, where intellectuals turn against their own intellect.
It's the opposite of what I think, but it kind of amounts to the same thing. I think it's a narcissistic staring at your own, at the reflection of your intellect in the mirror until you wither away and die.
Which is very Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, but, you know.
Well, yeah.
Going to go that way. I'm someone who's about to prepare a child to go off into tertiary education. It's terrifying. And the number two child was with me in Wellington, and he's looking at, part of the reason he wanted to do the event is he wants to study down there. And we went with another boy who's year 13 and is going to law school down there. And this is a boy who's also got quite conservative political leanings. They are literally having to galvanize themselves because all of these ideas, and there's no balance. Like for them, they're struggling to find balance in ideologies and arguments and expectations. Watch the space for the universities. I think things in our tertiary sector are going to get worse before they get better. In the US, I've just recorded it just before I did this, James Fishback, who will play this coming Wednesday, and he was saying that – universities there, they've hit that woke peak and they're now heading down the other side. Mm. And a number of key universities now are starting to pull back and saying, we are not going to issue.
Yeah. It's a bit like the financial system, isn't it? The banking system. The parasite is beginning to kill the host.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, I could keep going. There's so many articles in the paper that have their origins in AUT. And if you do a bit of reading through the academics, they're normally, you know, the people talking about climate change, you've got arts degrees. The Taylor Swift, the Pākehā project that was coming out of Massey University that was doing the gravy train workshops for government, you know, and then, you know, of course, you've got Emi Raukati, you know, the man who I was reading the codswallop about crime, you know, punishment being basically an enforcement of colonialism, Ronald Kramer. He works in the same area as Emi Raukati, and I'm not sure whether it's actually true. It wouldn't surprise me. It said that I saw something that stated that her doctorate were in studies transgenderism and niggerization of New Zealand. Now, niggerization, as far as I can tell, this is from an article in The Atlantic by Cornel West, who's kind of America's Moana Jackson. Niggerization is neither simply the dishonoring and devaluing of black people, nor solely the economic exploitation and political disenfranchisement of them. It is also the wholesale attempt to impede democratization, to turn potential citizens into intimidated, fearful, and helpless subjects. On the one hand, she's saying that, but, and I'll say she, you know, like, seems committed to it. She's got the lady's moko on her face. She describes herself as at least a critical Marxist scholar, but also claims to be a Leninist, which is astonishing. If you read what Leninism is, expounded by Vladimir Lenin, to guide the transition of society from capitalism to communism, the tenets of Marxism, which Lenin embraced, provided no concrete guidelines for the transition. So he kind of did the practical bit, and he believed that a small, disciplined, professional group of revolutionaries was needed to violently overthrow the capitalist system, and that a dictatorship of the proletariat must guide society until the day when the state would wither away. So this is the de-prison thing. Leninism in practice meant control of all aspects of life by the Communist Party and the creation of the first modern totalitarian state. Okay, so that's Leninism. Now, just do a sort of a thought experiment where someone says they're a Nazi. What happens then? But if you read the Encyclopedia Britannica definition of Nazism, it's a totalitarian movement led by Adolf Hitler as head of the Nazi Party in Germany, characterized by intense nationalism, mass appeal, dictatorial rule, and a vision of annihilation of all enemies of the Aryan Volk as the one and only goal of the Nazi policy. So, you know, tomato, tomato. You know, you've got race on one side, you've got class on the other. But it's essentially the same pudding.
Mm. Well, and also
the will to destroy. There's this idea, that favorite line of Marx is, everything that exists deserves to perish. It's an intensely destructive impulse that comes from all of this.
If you read James Lindsay's Race Marxism, critical race theory and everything evolved around it, all roads lead back to Marxism.
And then, you know, just overlying that, you've got the trivia of that, you know, that Taylor Swift summer school. And, you know, you can look at the senior lecturer who's offering that, Dr. Rebecca Trelease, completed her doctorate in 2019 in the genre of analysis of reality television. I wonder how often she's on a plane. Is there a doctor? Is there a doctor? Yes, I'm a doctor. This patient's choking. Oh, well, I've got a doctorate in the analysis of reality television. Can someone film this? Well, I mean, this is what women are stopping having babies to do. Do their doctorates in reality television. As I said, let's hear what Emi Raukati has to say. You know, I mean, go for it, but don't try and block people who want to reply, because that's where you get the Leninist bit of crushing opposition and trying to get the dictatorship of the proletariat going. But yeah, no, I mean, I've only just scratched the surface of the articles that had their origin and that sort of thing. You know, there's a lot of people commenting on the building of highways. And if you go to what they think, I mean, they're often, as I said, you know, worked for Greenpeace, have got arts degrees. Tim Welch wrote a thought piece about, you know, the folly of extending the highway up north. You know, his research is applied with a focus on equity and climate change. So, you know, they've got an agenda. Their agenda is the 15-minute cities. They are the useful idiots who are doing the work of, you know, the globalists who want, who think that we lump and proletariat consume too much and need a jackboot on our face forever.
So to that, one of the things that I found really interesting, looking at our theme, ideological application and real-world outcomes, is in the Saturday Herald on the, I can't even tell you what page it is. Page A4. There we go. Three articles, boom, 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 all sort of grouped together. The first one is butchery joins beef over lack of car parking, and it's around Westmere business owners in Auckland, and they've gone and whacked cycle lanes up left, right, centre, and just literally making it difficult for people to park. And so it talked to both a cafe, the Westmere butchery owner, and a cafe owner. And like the cafe owner, great example, Nick Cock, who owns the Twisted Tomato Cafe at Point Chev, said there was no earth for regular customers to park. He said the business had plummeted by 50% over 8 months. On Father's Day last weekend, Cock's cafe was fully booked. The food prepped and walk-ins were being turned away before the day turned to an absolute nightmare. He said people started calling the cafe to cancel their bookings after driving around and trying to find a car park and then just simply giving up.
Yeah. Well, there was a an interesting article in the New Zealand Herald on Tuesday, September the 10th. City planned to halve car use delusional, which was a comment Auckland councillor Daniel Newman made. Outline some of the targets that are driving this stuff that arise from the Paris Climate Accord. Among the targets are halving cars' share of distance travelled from 94 to 47%, increasing public transport trips from 100 million a year pre-COVID to 550 million, supercharging the use of bikes, e-bikes and e-scooters from less than 1% of the transport mode share to 13%. So as I've said, they're not building these cycle lanes in case you want a cycle. They're building them for when they give you no choice but to cycle.
Forced to cycle.
Mm. Yeah. And so this all arises from TERP, the Auckland Council's Transport Emissions Reduction Pathway. When TERP was approved, then-Mayor Phil Goff, Auckland Transport and Council officers were adamant there was time before 2030 to pull it off, saying Auckland could not only rely on incremental change, revolutionary change, comrade. Gough said the plan was transformational, ambitious, and tough because it has to be. Why has he not been recalled from being the diplomat in charge of our relationship with England? Bring his insect eyes back to his farm. Councillor Richard Hills, who chaired the Environment and Climate Change Committee when TERP was adopted, said the plan aligned with the Paris Agreement signed by the previous government and endorsed by the current government. The Paris Agreement targets are bold and will be hard for the government to meet, just like the TERP targets are for Auckland.
I'm sorry, I can't TERP. They couldn't come up with a better acronym than TERP. I mean, you and I have medical backgrounds. TERP. Obviously, they're wanting to try and improve the flow. Anyway,
PERT sounds better than TERP, but yeah.
Oh, dear. Well, again, it's at that page that I had. Jobs lost as capital cafe shut their doors. This was the hot topic when I was in Wellington. It was Pandora closing their doors. 28 years in business. This is a legacy business. 28 years in business. The owner, Tony Beasley, blames the struggling local economy with more people working from home and moves out of Wellington City Council to install cycleways and bus lanes, removing car parking for customers.
Mm. This is the same drive, and it's the same group of people. The single North motorway will eat 10% of spending. They quote 350 Aotearoa, climate change campaign group. They quote 350 Aotearoa campaigner Adam Curry as saying, and I'll put the accent on because he's Canadian, is this one motorway really worth one-tenth of our entire country's spending on schools, hospitals, hooses, and public transport infrastructure. Now, this guy was a Greenpeace agriculture and climate comms lead, did his master's degree in Otago at peace studies and conflict resolution, and before that did a political science degree in Canada. Yeah, the lunatics have been put in charge of the asylum often. Mm. And again, you know, let's hear from them. But when people who are that extreme are given comment, and this is Thomas Coughlin, who in some ways should know better, you know, and it's not balanced against actual realism about the effect of pinching off fossil fuels on an advanced Western economy at that sudden screeching halt. And the effect it's going to, the reason they're not honest about it is because you couldn't sell it.
But they're also not honest about as well as our power infrastructure. They're not honest about the fact that they have been pushing heavily for alternative energy like wind farms that still only represent a minuscule amount of our total power generation. And all that money, millions, billions and billions of dollars have been pushed into alternative energies to be part of these mythical accords. Well, I call them mythical accords because I think they're a whole load of rubbish, but they do that. And then when we actually have a real power crisis, because it hasn't been raining in the right spots, and we're having spiking power prices, you then have yesterday's paper, which our friend Thomas Coughlin has an article opining whether or not the issues in Wellington, are they actually, is there a real issue in terms of the financial pressures in Wellington, or are they just, you know, complaining too much and wah-wahing? And you only just scroll a few pages, a few stories down, and you've got the closure of the Winstone plants outside of Owakuni. Two plants, massive plants, who have now signalled their closure. They'd already kind of done a temporary closure with the power spiking in August. The power prices have come down. When you've got primary alpha employers in a small provincial area like, you know, Owakuni, Rahi, Wairu, all through there, now closing, over 200 jobs lost. People there, you know, these are career jobs. These people have been there for decades. They're the hub of the community, these employers. In less than a month, they're going to close. They haven't been able to get government intervention to help stabilise out the power prices. But I zoom out on this. They should never have had to be put into this point. These renewables aren't keeping up. How many of these businesses need to disappear from New Zealand and take all these people out of these regions to Australia elsewhere until they wake up? But again, what is the goal? What is the goal?
Yeah. The other thing you could add to that is, I mean, something like a pulp and paper mill is different from Wellington being a bit down at heel because they're actually exporting something. So they're bringing in foreign exchange. And Wellington just takes money out of the productive economy. So, you know, on the one hand, it's probably healthy if it withers a bit. But, yeah, they're not the same.
Well, Coughlin's analysis, when he did his analysis, he actually then did show, is Wellington worse off? Because they're feeling it. And Wellington traditionally has really low unemployment, always has. The statistics only cover the change of unemployment rates, which Chris Hipkins appears to be talking about when you look at the unemployment rate itself. Wellington is actually still performing well. The region's unemployment rate is 4.2% in the June quarter, in line with the national average, and lower than Auckland's 4.6%. Some perspective, both of these numbers are relatively low when taken in the context of the last couple of decades. Wellington is doing better than the Bay of Plenty, which, alongside having one of the highest unemployment rate increases in the country, it also claims the highest rate overall at 5.7% in the June quarter. Unemployment in the Bay of Plenty hasn't received much attention from politicians, and it probably should. In the past 12 months, the region has only once had an annual unemployment rate lower than Wellington is now. You live in the Bay of Plenty. Has there been much talk about unemployment up there?
No, I think there's still plenty of jobs, but it's still $10 taranga, so wages are lower here than they are, say, in Auckland or Wellington. Real estate's relatively expensive. I mean, it's second only to Sydney in terms of its unaffordability. So, you know, there are those same problems, and you know, there's the problem of the pipeline to employment, where there are jobs, but, you know, there are the education system's not necessarily turning out people you want to hire. They're well versed in some of the stuff that we're hearing out of AUT, the victimology and so on, but not necessarily turning up on time. That's a terribly bourgeois concept.
So in terms of the Wawa, so Wellington is 4.2, Gisborne and Hawke's Bay 4.1, Manawatu Wanganui 4.5, Canterbury 4.2, Bay Plenty 5.7, Waikato 5.4. Now, I guess part of the Wawa in Wellington is that a lot of these people that are losing their jobs, of course, you know, this is laptop and lanyard class. Will they actually roll sleeves up and get their hands dirty and actually do something that is productive or physical or manual elsewhere? Well, that's the difficulty. I think a lot of them won't, because they've got this higher education, they've got student loans, they've got all of these things. And they see that sort of level of higher education as a right, not a privilege. And I think, I just wonder whether some of them will find it really, really difficult, that if things do get worse, if the financial situation does tighten up even further, how many of them will actually pivot? Because we've all been told to pivot. Remember that, Marty? We got told to pivot.
Yeah, I love a bit of pivoting, though. I'm not like, you know, necessarily like everyone, but as I said, that voice in your head when you start working after you've been unemployed for a while, says, this just isn't fair. I mean, I'm only earning a dollar more an hour than I would be on the dole. That voice has got political representation by Chris Hipkins. He represents the whiny little excuse-making voice in everyone's head and encourages it.
Yeah. Speaking of whiny voices, Liam Dan.
He wrote an interesting summary of economists reflecting on, it was headlined, "We Are in Payback Time." Subheading is, "COVID economics is over, but what price are we going to have to pay?" There's a lot of the banks and bankers twisting the hair into pigtails and going, oh, well, I guess we had to, you know, charge a lot more money for money to make everyone think it was worth something. But it was an interesting confirmation of Robert McCulloch's observation that people like Liam Dan, who aren't overly knowledgeable about economics, like talking to bank economists, and so they get invited to Reserve Bank stuff. So they want to be kind of part of the establishment. And so as a consequence, they very carefully keep dissenting voices out of the paper. Although, I mean, I always enjoy hearing from Oliver Hartwich of the New Zealand Initiative. He and Cameron Bagri, Tony Alexander had an interesting comment. But if you listen to, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of bank economists, and Kelly Eckhold, Westpac chief economist, her comment, drum roll for Liam Dan article, well, guess.
Monetary theory is working. Monetary theory is working.
Monetary policy eventually works. Another big lesson from the pandemic era was that people hate inflation. And Sharon Zolmer, ANZ chief economist, the passionate hatred of inflation is what struck me too. People despise inflation, even if median incomes are keeping pace. Stephen Topless of the BNZ head of research, it's difficult to reach any conclusion other than New Zealand policymakers got it wrong, with both the government and RBNZ sharing in some of the blame. The extent of the lockdowns, the fiscal response, the monetary response, and the coordination between fiscal and monetary policy. So monetary policy involves changing the interest rate and influencing the money supply, and fiscal policy involves the government changing tax rates and levels of government spending to influence aggregate demand in the economy. So a theme in all of this is that it appeared the left hand didn't know what the right hand's doing. I don't buy that. I don't buy that those WEF puppets and Adrian Orr, let's worship a tree every morning, you know, weren't, you know, cognizant of what they were doing, you know, or at least weren't being told by people what to do who were cognizant of what was going to happen, that corporations were going to get a whole lot richer and
I wonder whether there's a whole bunch of narcissists, like, we want to look good for our mates stuff with this, you know, like it becomes a self-perpetuating spiral. So you've got someone that sows the kernel of what they want the outcome to be, and then you've got a whole bunch of useful idiots like
So this is still from Stephen Topless. Ultimately, excessive provision of free money ends up causing inflation. Inflation problems, particularly in asset prices. And finally, people have amazing resilience in the face of adversity. But the plank of the week has to go to Nick Tuffley, the ANZ chief economist. Tuffley picks up on the resilience of people throughout the pandemic. Never underestimate the ingenuity of people to rise to challenges in a way we don't during peacetime. The ingenuity of resources put into developing vaccines were huge. Saving lives and giving politicians and individuals the courage sooner to reopen to the world. I mean, the best bit is this. We took the kitchen sink approach to prop the economy up. In hindsight, the support, particularly monetary policy, was too much. But we didn't know that at the time. Being cautious and doing too little would have been a worse place to be in. New Zealand got through 2020 and over half of 2021 remarkably well. But stimulus just brings forward activity from the future. And we are now in the payback time. So being cautious and doing too little would have been exactly where we wanted to be, Nick. Sweden's anything to go by.
I'm sorry. That peacetime and resilience, we're about as far from the blitz that we could have ever been during that time. I listened to Mary Nelson on Legal Hub yesterday, right? And she was talking about the liquidations that were going on with businesses and the liquidations that have been initiated by IRD.
Mm.
And she said so many of those IRD staff probably have forgotten that whilst they were sitting at home on full pay, working, you know, doing a little bit of work and everything is fine.
Being a parasite that kills the organism.
Yes. Those who were running businesses were told by their leader, you know, please keep your staff. We're going to throw, Squealer's going to throw you some money. We're going to help you out a little bit. Please don't lay your staff off. Please try and hold on to them. We're going to get through this. We're going to look after you. But ultimately, when you're still paying your staff, even if it is with helicopter money, you still have to pay the PAYE. And then, of course, did everything miraculously recover and come back to life just as it was before? No. We turned into the Hermit Kingdom. If you were in hospitality, it then became difficult. And then to add insult to injury, you have a second lockdown, which gets extended in Auckland. And then you have a two-tier society where you lock out, as they claim, oh, but it was, you know, we had a vaccination rate of 96% or whatever the stupid number was. We've only, you know, it's only that.
Lives.
That's only that number of people. No, it's not that number of people, because a lot of those people not have their children vaccinated. So then a family wouldn't go out together because the 12-year-old didn't have a vaccine certificate, or those who were wanting to have a family event wouldn't actually go out and have a family event. They'd choose to do something at home because they'd have one or two family members who'd made the courageous decision to actually, look, we're going to sit this one out, thanks. So instead of excluding them, they, you know, pulled the cancellation home. When the vaccine certificates came into play, sorry, I'm ranting now. When the vaccine certificates came into play, there was a hospitality business that we frequented, wonderful business. They were fully booked for Christmas functions. And they were thinking, wow, finally, Christmas 21 after the lockdowns and how slow things were in 2020, they were really looking forward to Christmas 21. That date was announced, what was it, 15 December? That date was announced, 50% of their bookings cancelled in the first 24 hours of those certificates being announced because of the phenomenon of businesses not wanting to exclude those that chose not to get vaccinated. That doesn't get talked about, Stephen Zollner. You don't talk about that. And that's, I'm sorry, peacetime and resilience, my ass. That's the resilience that needs to be talked about, are those businesses that are still trying to keep themselves alive, functioning, paying staff and not being closed down by the IRD after the mismanagement of the, oh, monetary policy is working, types like you. Okay, all right. Ooh, I've got that out of my system now.
I'd just be repeating myself talking about how Marxist student politicians have never employed anyone, so they don't know what it's like when you have to let your best staff go and then you got to try and rebuild your business with a bunch of people who you know, don't provide influence to new staff to do things the way you want, like the amount that sets you back is incredible because you've lost all your number ones. And the rebuild, it's just an incredibly difficult task. I feel so sorry for all the tourism businesses, all the hospitality business. It's a quixotic thing to be in at the best of times, and they just got shafted. I do want to, before I finish this, Tony Alexander, independent economist, spoke the most sense. Well, he and Hartwich. So Tony Alexander said, actions by both the Reserve Bank and Finance Minister over the pandemic were ultimately failures. They started with successes in 2020 by containing the drop in the economy and sentiment, but this was wiped out by the failure to recognize the impact of their measures and the quick erasure of their need to be continued in 2021. Ultimately, many of the thousands of businesses closing currently and people losing employment are in this position because of the 2021 to 22 policy failures. Act and assess. Cameron Baggery, COVID became an excuse to do anything as opposed to targeted COVID relief, aka a slush fund, he said. I don't think the RBNZ fully appreciated the scale of fiscal stimulus that was being pumped into the economy, which meant they went too far loosening monetary conditions. True. And then, as I said, Oliver Hartwich, became clear by around May 2020 that our situation was nothing like the other events. This was not a Keynesian demand slump. No, with all the supply chain disruptions and people still working from home, this looked much more like an exogenous supply shock. If it was the former, then stimulus might have been justified. If it was the latter, stimulus would have been made a bad situation worse because the extra stimulus would have encountered a reduced supply and just resulted in higher prices. Well, it turns out that's exactly what happened. So while many central banks kept treating it like a normal recession, the administered medicine turned out to be the wrong one. The single biggest takeaway for me was the realization that getting your fundamental economic analysis right really matters. Amen.
Indeed.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
Well, before we head off, we did get comment last week that they did like our Helen Clark voices. Both of you did our best Helens. So you're back again tomorrow with Fourth Estate. Who have you got on the board, Miss Ford, for tomorrow?
Oh, I've got the old gang back together. It's me, Rachel Stewart, and Peter Williams, which is always good fun. Peter's always always enjoy both of them. I think Rachel wants to talk about guns. Something about talking about guns with Rachel I enjoy. I no doubt we'll go over the debate, the presidential debate. So that's pretty momentous. And I think we have to talk about Paddy Gower a little bit. And no doubt just the ongoing issues around Māori wards and the Treaty Principles Bill will probably take a bit of time and tune in and see what else.
Yep, always something to wear. Oh, yes, I do like you. You three are a really good combination. I look forward to that. So, of course, tomorrow is at noon. Well, there we go. All right, well, you and I are going to do this again. So Thursday's 1 o'clock.
All right.
This is when you're going to find us now. This is our new home.
Shuffling our paper.
I know, shuffling our paper, a new home. And, of course, I'll be back with Counterculture on Wednesdays between 10 and noon.
Awesome.
And you will be doing the Fourth Estate tomorrow from noon.
Get it together, lovers. It's up to us.
Yep. And of course, repeat, if you missed breakfast this morning, we'll do it all again coming up next on Reality Check Radio. Thanks, Marty.
Thanks so much, Marie. Have a great week, everyone.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.